No one would have believed in the last years of the 20th century that human affairs were being watched keenly and closely by intelligences greater than man's and yet as mortal as his own. That as people busied themselves about their affairs, they were scrutinized and studied perhaps almost as narrowly as someone with a microscope might scrutinize the transient creatures that swarm and multiply in a drop of water. With infinite complacency, people went to and fro over this globe about their little affairs, serene in their assurance of their empire over matter. It is possible that the Infusorians under the microscope do the same. No one. Struck again in London, and this is, I don't know, that was H.G. Wells, the opening of War of the Worlds, because we seem to be in a War of the Worlds, don't you know? This is Kill Radio's Thursday Impressionistic News Hour. What the hell? Why does the microphone sound so bad? There, that's a little better. And I'm your faithless host, Bennett. We have some things to cover today, don't we? Badger Kitten posted this to the Indie Media UK site just a few hours ago. So this is a description from somebody who was there. I was on a crowded train to work. It was 8:40 a.m. when I boarded the rammed Piccadilly Line train at Finsbury Park. Normally I board halfway up the train, but the train was so full I walked up to the front of the train to board. I was on the first carriage, the one behind the driver's carriage, by the doors. It was absolutely packed, and even more people got on at King's X, making it what felt like the most crowded train ever. Then, as we left King's X, about 5 to 9, there was an almighty bang, and everything went totally black. Then clouds of choking smoke filled the tube carriage, and I thought I had been blinded. It was so dark that nobody could see anything. I thought I was about to die, or was dead. Then I realized I was choking. The smoke was like being underwater, but gradually I could see, a little, as the emergency lights in the tunnel kicked in. The glass was smashed, so air started to flood in. We were okay. There was silence for 10 seconds. Then a terrible screaming. We all tried not to panic. We said to each other, okay, stay cool, stand up if you aren't injured, hold hands, don't cry, stand up, hold on, we'll get out, the driver's trying to talk to us. Some people screamed, some groaned, but we kept saying, shh, we'll get along, stay cool, the driver's talking to us, let's listen to him. The driver said, I've got to go forward a bit, then I can let you out, but first I need to make sure the track isn't live. So we all shouted the message back into the darkness. It got passed down the train into the darkness. Then, after about 20 to 30 minutes, we started to leave the train. It was choking on there, so we were trying not to panic because we knew that would be curtains. We tried to keep each other calm. I remember saying, if anyone's boss gives them grief for being late, we know what to say to them, eh, girls? And people laughed. We kept saying, not long. It's the long walk to freedom, nearly there. I knew if we panicked, we'd trip on the possibly live tracks, and things would be hopeless. So we just tried to stay cool and trust we'd be safe soon. We'd escaped from the smashed carriage. We just had to stay calm and escape from the dark tunnel, too. We walked carefully through the semi-darkness. We didn't know if the tracks were live, so we walked between them. The emergency lights were on in the tunnel. We walked in single file to Russell Square Station, and after what felt like a half an hour, we were lifted off the tracks to safety, and I was in a lift, euphorically calm. Then in the station foyer, surrounded by filthy, blackened, shocked people, someone handing me water. That's from Badger Kitten, evidently a worker in London. There's more to it. Go to the Indie Media UK site for more. I don't know. I really don't know. What do you do? This past Monday was the 229th anniversary of the signing of the Declaration of Independence. It was also the 29th year since Western civilization peaked back in 1976. This is the weekly news and review posted on July 5th by Paul Ford for the Harpers.org website. I'm Bennett, your faithless host for KillRadio.org. The news, of course, involves the preceding week. The U.S. Capitol was evacuated for a few minutes. China Export and Credit Insurance Corporation was planning to buy Huffy Bikes. Senator Gaylord Nelson died. NASA smashed a coffee table-sized device traveling at 23,000 miles per hour into the Tempel 1 comet. And Toyota announced that it would open a new $800 million plant in Ontario. The company turned down hundreds of millions of dollars in subsidies in the United States because, when compared to Canadians, U.S. workers are too hard to train, often illiterate, religious fanatics, and expensive to insure. A Japanese man recited 84,431 digits of pi. And the state of Georgia legalized fishing with only your hands. The owner of the New England Patriots football team took off his 14-karat gold Super Bowl ring to show to Vladimir Putin. Putin put the ring in his pocket and kept it. A member of Britain's parliament identified himself as a Jedi. And a trader for Taiwan's Fubon Securities accidentally purchased $223 million worth of the wrong stocks. A woman in Florida won the right to bare her breasts in public. Genetic engineers were growing a SARS vaccine in tomatoes. And a suicide melon truck exploded in Mosul, killing six people and damaging many melons. In New Zealand, a baby boy undergoing penis enlargement treatment was accidentally given 10 times the recommended dose of testosterone by his nurse, causing the boy to become angry and irritable and to develop pubic hair. A doctor warned that the baby might also suffer from painful erections, but that problem had yet to arise. President George W. Bush gave a nationally televised speech about the war in Iraq to an audience of soldiers. Bush, who served in the Air National Guard, said there was no higher calling than military service and mentioned the September 11, 2001 terrorist attacks five times. After the speech, there was some question as to whether the soldiers had clapped enough. The U.S. Army, having increased the maximum enlistment age from 34 to 39, and the maximum age for officer candidate school from 29 to 42, having offered $20,000 more for college per soldier, and having lowered the recruitment goal for this June by more than 1,000 as compared to the previous year, announced that it had exceeded its June recruitment goal by 507 soldiers. I wonder how they managed to work that, don't you? And meanwhile, right-wingers on radio stations across the country are completely in denial about the recruitment problem. A group of U.S. senators visited Guantanamo Bay and said that prisoners there were being treated humanely. Prisoners even have air conditioning, said Senator Jim Bunning of Kentucky, and semi-private showers. Scientists in Pittsburgh killed a dog, then resurrected it hours later with fresh blood. And Sandra Day O'Connor announced that she would retire from the Supreme Court. Conservative groups immediately began fighting to keep Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez from being nominated to replace her because he is not conservative enough. 16 people died when a U.S. Chinook helicopter was shot down in Afghanistan, and a fourth American soldier in Iraq converted to Islam. It was uncertain whether Iran's new president had been involved in taking 52 Americans hostage at the U.S. Embassy in Tehran in 79 or not. A cleric in Lebanon issued a fatwa banning the shooting of guns into the air. China decided to outlaw sexual harassment. And a South Korean pastor announced that he had raised enough money to send 1.2 million rabbits to North Korea. In Kota Bangludd, Malaysia, a Kedzen Susan chief Bobolian urged people to stop dressing animals in costumes because doing so offends the spirits and could turn a longhouse to stone. A farmer in Nicktown, Pennsylvania, was rendered immobile when he fell through a barn floor and broke his thigh bone. The loud noise of his fall scared his cows, who trampled him to death. A 60-million-year-old venomous mouse fossil was discovered by a Canadian. 50 new species of snail were discovered in Sri Lanka. And a Zamboni driver in Morristown, New Jersey, was charged with drunk Zamboni driving. In Indonesia, the Islamic Defenders Front unsuccessfully attempted to stop a transvestite beauty show. A woman in Hoogeveen, the Netherlands, turned 115. A man in New Hampshire was arrested for hiding inside an outhouse tank. And a kangaroo was loose in Indiana. Or is that just urban legend? The estimated number of hedgehogs in Britain was found to have dropped 20% since 2001, probably because tidy gardens alienate hedgehogs. It was discovered that killer jellyfish will swim away from the color red, and that baby dolphins do not sleep. Two Brooklyn, New York teenagers were arrested for killing a 15-year-old boy for his iPod. France announced that it would build a nuclear fusion reactor, and Canada's parliament voted to allow gay marriages. Iran sentenced a man to have his eyes surgically removed. And in Muncie, Indiana, a paraplegic man was on his way to Mount Zion Baptist Church when his motorized wheelchair became stuck on some train tracks. He was thrown 10 yards and killed by a 38 car freight train. Lightning struck a sleeping child's mattress in Kansas, sparked a wildfire in Alaska's interior, shocked a boy in New Hampshire through his video game controller, killed both a golfer and a prisoner in Ohio, and struck the offices of the National Weather Service in Iowa. The Association of British Insurers estimated that global warming will result in $27 billion worth of storm damage annually by 2080. Scientists in India warned that the Himalayan glacier that feeds the Ganges River would probably melt before the end of this century. And in Tobi, Japan, a panther stood on its hind legs and clasped its paws together in the posture of prayer. Well, there you go. Can your heart take it? That's the news in review. Thanks, Paul Ford. Thanks, Harpers.org. And thank you for listening.
Ladies and gentlemen, the President of the United States, George W. Bush.
Today, the gravest danger in the war on terror is the United States of America. It is not only repressing its own people, it is threatening people everywhere. America remains by history and by choice a slave-holding society. Its goal is remaking the world, one heart and one soul at a time. As long as the United States of America is determined not to defend, but to conquer, to plot evil and destruction, I will live and lead by these principles and by the might of the United States of America. Set out to dominate the weak and intimidate the world.
You do, and it'll be the biggest mistake you ever made, you Texas brush popper.
We are not open to negotiation or discussion. We will not tire. We will not falter. And we will not fail. We have found our mission and our moment. War with great love. War never finishing. An age of terror, blackmail threats, violence, cruelty, politics, depression, fear, and mass murder. In a world of chaos and constant alarm, no peace at all. America's gift to the world, the American people,
flawed and fallible people,
assured of the rightness of our cause and confident of the victories to come. We know that God is not neutral. Responsible citizens, I urge you to kill all Americans,
all of us,
across the world, including women and children. We are enemies of freedom.
We are failures of love. Set us free.
The American flag reduces all the richness of life to a single destructive desire. Australia and Africa, Latin America, El Salvador, India, Iran, Mexico and Japan, Caribbean, Afghanistan, Great Britain. It could be you. We bring justice, patient justice, freedom, liberty,
pain of poverty, aggression.
War goes on. American justice will be done.
And this is my solemn pledge. The vulnerable will suffer most.
These problems will not be solved singing God Bless America. America's future is one of fear. In the name of Allah, help wanted.
The best things in life are free, but you can give them to the birds and bees. I want money. Such a thrill, but your love won't pay my bills. I want money. That's what I want. That's what I want. That's what I want. Don't get everything, it's true. What it don't get, I can't use. I want money. Money. Just
was a small child, we lived in the hills without neighbors nearby. Our closest neighbors were white trash, as distinct from poor whites. White trash were different because they flaunted their poverty, reveled in it, and were not ashamed. Poor whites, like poor blacks, were committed to trying to find work and lay claim to respectability. They were law-abiding and patriotic. White trash saw themselves as above the law, and as a consequence, they were dangerous. White trash were folks who, as our neighbors were fond of saying, did not give a good gosh darn. They were not afraid to take the Lord's name in vain. Most poor white folks did not want to live anywhere near black folks. White trash lived everywhere. Writing in the anthology White Trash, Race and Class in America, Constance Penley comments in Crackers and Whackers, a southern white child is required to learn that white trash folks are the lowest of the low because socially and economically they have sunk so far that they might as well be black. As such, they are seen to have lost all self-respect. So it is particularly unseemly when they appear to shamefully flaunt their trashiness, which, after all, is nothing but an aggressively in-your-face reminder of stark class difference. Privileged class southern white folks sometimes saw white trash as more disgusting than black folks, but in the end of the day, they lived by the creed that white stands with white and white makes it right. Our hillbilly white trash neighbors lived by their own codes and rules. We did not call them names because we knew the pain of slurs. Mama made it clear that they were people just like us and they were to be shown respect. While they did not bother us and we did not bother them, we...
Starting today, you are your future.
The Nine Steps to Financial Freedom.
Your Nine Steps to Financial Freedom. Freedom to live a life your way. Nine Steps.
What do you want from your money? College tuition for your kids? A bigger house and a new car? $1 million for that?
Sometime during this year of 2005, sometime, somewhere in one of the major cities across this earth, a baby will be born and it will change human history. Not the baby itself, that will go unrecognized. But for the first time, the urban population of the earth is going to outnumber the rural population. It may have already happened. In 1950, there were 86 cities in the world with populations over 1 million. Today, there are 386 cities with populations of over 1 million. By 2015, there will likely be about 550. The present urban population in the big cities is 3 billion people, which is larger than the total population of the Earth in 1960. The global countryside will reach its maximum population, 3.3 billion, in 2020, and thereafter will begin to decline. As a result, cities will account for all future world population growth, which is expected to peak at about 9 billion in 2050. Again, in 1960, we reached 3 billion. By today, we're at 6 billion people on the Earth. And over the next 40 years, we're going to reach 9 billion, which is considered to be about the maximum that the planet can house comfortably. What this massive amount of change means, for instance, the city of Lagos in Africa had a population of 300,000 in 1950. Today, there are 10 million people in that city. By 2025, Shanghai could have as many as 27 million residents. And Bombay in India is projected to attain a population of 33 million people. We're about to experience a massive change in pretty much everything we've ever known. The largest number of children ever on the face of the earth, more children today than there were on earth, say, 100 years ago, are about to reach sexual maturity. They're going to have millions and millions and millions of babies. We've heard about overpopulation for 40, 50 years. Zero population growth is a concept that people have talked about, fought about for ages. There are countries, Japan and Italy come to mind right away, where the birth rate is actually lowering. I believe in Italy it's down to 0.8 children per family, which means that it's less than one child per married couple. And in the long run, in a country like Italy, perhaps in Japan as well, the population is going to start to go downward. Okay. But in Africa, India, Asia, South America, the populations are going to grow. This means, in this country, in the United States, it means immigration is going to be stretched to its ultimate limits, as there's going to be massive numbers of people coming to this country to reap the benefits of its capitalist city structure. We're already seeing a relativity about the social society changing. We are seeing a relativity base in social rules, ethnic bases in what is good or bad. I mean, the simple fact that we have Latin Grammys shows a change over the past 30, 40 years in this country. This change, we want to, you know, obviously we'd like to make it be a good change. We'd like to make it be a good thing, maybe more tolerance, more openness to ultimate societies. But it's going to affect everything. It's going to affect water. It's going to affect food. Last week I talked about, or Brian Eno talked about, the peak of civilization, of security, of access to clean water, etc., that Western civilization peaked in 1976. Automatically, when I say that to most people, they just deny it. Ah, no, that's not true. Well, maybe it's not, but it gives us a way to look at how changes are. We definitely don't feel as secure. The bombing in London today shows once again that if we're fighting terrorism, we're not really stopping anything because it's still going on. We don't want to suppress the having of children, yet that's what's it's going to have. It's going to affect our food, our water, everything. We are faced in this country with religious fanaticism, unfortunately Christian fanaticism, that is just as potent and ugly in its own way as Islam fanatics. The Christians, the right-to-lifers, think that every life is sacred for some reason, except after it's born, then they don't really care about it, but if, as long as it's in the womb, it's sacred. And they're missing the point totally, which is that it would be better off if more of us didn't make it into this world. So look around you and realize that it's just going to continue on this path. This masses and teeming masses of people gathering, many of them with different accents, different ways of speaking, different ways of thinking, and they're going to continue to just continue massing in. And I don't say that there's anything to do about it except be aware of it and make plans accordingly. the future and the war of the world.
Everything must be judged by its cost, and everything has a price. What is offered for free or at bargain rates often comes with a psychological price tag. Complicated feelings of obligation, compromises with quality, the insecurity those compromises bring, and on and on. The powerful learn early to protect their most valuable resources, independence, and room to maneuver. By paying the full price, they keep themselves free of dangerous entanglements and worries.
The gene. Ka-ching.
Being open and flexible with money also teaches the value of strategic generosity, a variation on the old trick of giving what you are about to take. By giving the appropriate gift, you put the recipient under obligation. Generosity softens people up to be deceived. By gaining a reputation for liberality, you win people's admiration while distracting them from your power plays. By strategically spreading your wealth, you charm the other courtiers, creating pleasure and making valuable allies. For everyone able to play with money, thousands more are locked in a self-destructive refusal to use money creatively and strategically. These types represent the opposite pole to the powerful, and you must learn to recognize them, either to avoid their poisonous natures or to turn their inflexibility to your advantage. The greedy fish. The greedy fish take the human side out of money. Cold and ruthless, they see only the lifeless balance sheet, viewing others solely as either pawns or obstructions in their pursuit of wealth. No one wants to work with the greedy fish, and over the years they end up isolated, which often proves their undoing. The bargain demon. Powerful people judge everything by what it costs, not just in money, but in time, dignity, and peace of mind. And this is exactly what bargain demons cannot do. Wasting valuable time digging for bargains, they worry endlessly about what they could have gotten elsewhere for little less. On top of that, the bargain item they buy is often shabby, perhaps it needs costly repairs, or will have to be replaced twice as fast as a high-quality item. The costs of these pursuits, not always in money, but in time and peace of mind, discourage normal people from undertaking them. But for the bargain demon, the bargain is an end in itself. These types may seem to harm only themselves, but their attitudes are contagious. Unless you resist them, they will infect you with the insecure feeling that you should have looked harder to find a cheaper price. Do not argue with them or try to change them. Just mentally add up the cost in time and inner peace of the irrational pursuit of a bargain. The same.
Money. Life. teeming masses, the war of the worlds, here on the Impressionistic News Hour on Kill Radio. Ho, ho.
In the lamb, I rock the fetish people. You know who I am.
Yes, man, we got the style that's wicked. I hope you can all keep up. We climbed all the way from the bottom to the top. Now we ain't getting nothing but love.
If I was a rich girl, na 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 na.
About money remains taboo in polite society. I never meet wealthy people who speak about themselves as rich. More often than not, people of means display their wealth and the status it gives them through material objects, where they live, shop, what they own. While they may not speak openly about money, many wealthy individuals think about their riches all the time. Possessing wealth in a greedy culture, where millions of poor people live without the basic necessities of life, they work to hold on to what they have, using it to make more. Protecting their class interests takes time. Many wealthy people live in fear that the people they meet want to get their money from them, and as a consequence, thinking about money often dominates their personal relationships. On television and in magazines, the rich were and are fictively depicted as caring and generous toward impoverished classes. They are portrayed as eager to cross class boundaries and hang with diverse groups of people. Unlike the undeserving poor or the unenlightened middle classes, these images tell that the wealthy do not long to just stay with folks like themselves. And more importantly, they suffer as much as anyone else. By the 80s, the only image of the poor we were likely to see on television screens came across on cop shows or in the occasional hospital drama. Usually, when they appear, the poor are demonized. They are self-centered, corrupt, and dysfunctional. Depicted as liars and schemers, they are usually criminals. On television, the working class are allowed to be funny now and then. Roseanne, a show that portrayed the white working class in a complex way, stayed on the air for a long time, yet its popularity could not be sustained in a world where no one really wants to be identified as working class. Producers and viewers tend to keep on the air programs with negative depictions of the working class, which show them to be petty, unkind, xenophobic, and racist toward any group unlike themselves. Nowadays, where sitcoms of the working class used to appear on our screens, a range of shows featuring upper-middle-class young people abound. On these shows, identification with wealth and privilege is depicted as a norm. The fact that the television well-to-do are in their late 20s and early 30s strengthens the myth that anyone who works hard can make it. None of these shows reflect any aspect of the growing class divisions in our society. By the end of the 80s, images of working class and poor people appeared on television screens primarily in cop shows. Depicted as lacking in morals, as criminals, as without humanizing affection, these images promote disdain for the underprivileged and identification with the privileged. The rich are able to make notions of unlimited growth and expansion work for them economically. The throwaway culture of planned obsolescence that this mode of thinking and being has produced, while useful to the rich, has utterly undermined the class power of the middle class, working class, and poor people. Wanting and wasting are practices that keep the have-nots from utilizing their limited material resources in the most life-enhancing and productive ways. Since the vast majority of these folks imagine that the rich are indulging every desire, they have no understanding of the ways the rich use their resources to produce more resources for themselves.
Sunday, I went to see The War of the Worlds. I'd been looking forward to it since I first saw that Spielberg got the rights for it back about 3 years ago, and then Cruise had signed to do it. And then it was pushed up because he didn't have a director for his next Mission Impossible movie. And I had an amazing experience watching War of the Worlds. It's made me think a lot about America, because it's the 4th of July weekend, and about what Spielberg does. See, now I'm no jaded. I'm no novice film watcher. I'm pretty jaded. I've pretty much seen a million movies. And I know them very well. Spielberg used to piss me off all the time, even though I was quite enervated by his early films. I'm old enough to have followed his career all along, and I was pretty impressed with some of the early stuff. But then I began to get really annoyed by the time of Close Encounters and those films in the through the 80s. It seems to me that he set up a sort of amusement park ride movie, which affected Hollywood horribly, as so many other filmmakers have tried to do what Spielberg did, and he didn't give you any room. You just had to go along for the ride. But in the last 10 years or so, he's reached such a point as a film artist that he actually has allowed that meditative distance to start to appear in his films. It's been going on for several years, and the last few years have seen some really dark and twisted Spielberg films. I still get annoyed in Saving Private Ryan. The opening 20-minute sequence while horrifying, it's back to the roller coaster ride. We're just meant to ride with it, and there's no real space inside it to observe it. You just feel this horror of the D-Day experience, and it's even stronger in a theater or home theater environment where the sound and the image are so potent. It's dark and horrifying, but it's also kind of pointless, because what is it supposed to mean? I mean, it's not, Saving Private Ryan is not an anti-war movie. So why are we experiencing this horror to such a degree that you can barely take it? Well, it's because of the dark side of Spielberg. Later in the film, there are some brilliant moments where there is meditative distance, and it's like looking into a well. There's so much depth there, which is why he's a great artist. And even more recently, Minority Report is an astonishing film about prescience in thought crime, and AI is the most detached, cold, horrifying film about the concept of something that will love forever and never stop loving for thousands of years while nothing loves it back. The horrible darkness and sadness of that. And in fact, the images of frightened children are very potent, running through all of Spielberg's work. Now, I say all that, War of the Worlds, I go there yesterday, it's packed in the theater. I'm not real comfortable in my chair. I have to sit very close to the screen. I'm a big guy. I'm surrounded by people munching fucking popcorn and all this. All this annoyance. This movie scared the fuck out of me. I was startled. I was hit hard. I was shaken when I left the theater. I mean, like all Spielberg films, it resolves in such a way that you're not going to feel too terrible walking out of the place. No attempts to spoil anything for you, but if you've read the book, heard the radio play, seen the 50s movie, they all have the same ending as this one. So you already know the ending. What this film has is the sense of being there in something that's more potent than you can understand. And that's the way so much of us, so many of us, experience the world. There's an audacity to present what is essentially September 11th style imagery into a science fiction horror concept, and to present it in such detail that you simply experience it. There is plenty of meditative distance. That's the amazing, frightening thing about the film, because you are given distance. Now, I predict that the majority of people who see the film will just think of it as some special effects film, or they'll have some flash-in-the-pan ideas about Tom Cruise's behavior of recent weeks, none of which matters. The film is here for the long run. That stuff is just for the summer of 2005. But this film will be here 20 years from now, and it's still going to have the power to affect. There's a deep sense here of something grave that we need to understand about ourselves. And it is political. It's very political, but it's not political in rational terms. It's political in irrational terms. I was startled by this film. I'm going to be annoyed at how people are going to just simply dismiss it. It's just another movie. When I was shaken to my roots, I saw something, I experienced something. I've never been so scared in a movie theater. And I'm an adult, you know? This isn't kid stuff. This is shakeable stuff. So, you know, if you go in cynical and say you're not going to be impressed by anything, well, fuck you. You're an idiot. You're missing the point. you need to go and experience this, because this is the way the world is. And it's sure, it's film, it's theater, it's an artistic view. But wow, And there's no sidetracking. There's nothing that gets in the way. And it's not sentimental, even though it's about family. Instead, we're treated. Oh, I'm sure I can be picky. There are a couple moments that have little Spielberg qualities to them, but they didn't bother me. They didn't get in the way. So, here, you know, from Kill Radio, from Bennett, from the dark side of Steven Spielberg, War of the Worlds. Whoa.
America, 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 America. $2.27, January 17th, 1956. I can't stand my own mind. America, when will we end the human war? I don't feel good, don't bother me. I won't write my poem until I'm in my right mind. America, when will you be angelic? When will you take off your clothes? When will you look at yourself through the grave? When will you be worthy of your million Trotskyites? America, why are your libraries full of tears? America, when will you send your eggs to India? I'm sick of your insane demands. When can I go into the supermarket and buy what I need with my good looks? America, after all, it is you and I who are perfect, not the next world. Your machinery is too much for me. You made me want to be a saint. There must be some other way to settle this argument. Are you being sinister, or is this some form of practical joke? I'm trying to come to the point. I refuse to give up my obsession. America, stop pushing. I know what I'm doing. America, plum blossoms are falling. I haven't read the newspapers for months. America, I used to be a communist when I was a kid. I'm not sorry. I smoke marijuana every chance I get. My mind is made up. There's going to be trouble, and be trouble, and be trouble, and be trouble.
If you think that your kid is not ready for certain kinds of environmental stimulation, I think it's okay to talk about that.
Ladies and gentlemen, the President of the United States.
Death of democracy for the American people. Discredit their narrow ideology. Death of democracy for the American people. We will make this an age of war and misery. Progress must end. I've come here tonight to report to all Americans they are mistaken. They have endorsed representative government, and we've taken steps to correct them. Human beings will not be tolerated. Such an opportunity. Death of democracy for the American people. Discredit their narrow ideology. Death of democracy for the American people. We will make this an age of war and misery. It is the commitment of our government and my personal commitment to wear out the patience of Americans. Our desire to be safe from brutal and bullying oppression will fade and die away. We must keep our focus. Death of democracy for the American people. Discredit their narrow ideology. Death of democracy for the American people. We will make this an age of war and misery. The return of tyranny is right and just. We want its words to have meaning. We'll deny civilized behavior a base of operation and export more violence. Progress must end. Killing to achieve our goals. Killing as necessary. Chaos to achieve our goals. Chaos as necessary. Killing to achieve our goals. Killing as necessary. Chaos to ensure our money is spent wisely and effectively. Killing to achieve our goals. Killing as necessary. Chaos to achieve our goals. Chaos as necessary. Killing to achieve our goals. Killing as necessary. Chaos to ensure our money is spent wisely and effectively. Killing to achieve our goals.
killing is necessary. Chaos would keep our goals. Chaos is necessary. Killing would keep our goals. Killing is necessary. Chaos.
Chaos. Chaos. Chaos.
Death of democracy for the American people. Discredit their narrow ideology. Death of democracy for the American people. We will make this an age of war and misery. Death of democracy. We must keep our focus. Death of democracy. Progress must end. Death of democracy. We must keep our focus. Death of democracy. Progress must end. The world has a clear interest in the spread of democratic values, and we will not allow it. A civil society will cease to exist. A harsh society in which women are voiceless is an essential commitment of our strategy. Death of democracy. Death of democracy.
If you're in Los Angeles, people are meeting in front of the London consulate over in West Hollywood to give to voice support for the people of London. Today's bombing actually fit in with the theme of what I was doing today, teeming masses and money and revolution and the death of democracy and money and money and money. This experiment in terror by Henry Mancini and me, your faithless host Bennett, and killradio.org is the Impressionistic News Hour, where I appropriate material from around me and present it to you to see what you can do about it. This is an active show. This is not about sitting there and going, oh. This is about doing something. Damn it. But what are you going to do? Well, you can listen to my music show Saturday nights at midnight. You can listen to Radio for All. Go around and listen to the pieces on Radio for All. You can listen to Upstart Radio, which won the Live 365 Award for Best Political Radio Station. You can come to our Critical Masses here the last Friday of every month. You can think. And think. And think. And think. And think. Thanks for listening to Kill Radio. Don't forget to kill your friend.